Welcome to Real GM Radio. I'm Danny Lur, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Jared Dubin of Last Night in Basketball, and he was a perfect person to talk with because a big part of this podcast is going around the league and kind of getting status updates on the playoff races and where these teams are, and Jared follows the entire league and does so extremely well. And we get into a lot of different stuff, the playoff races, some of the teams that are struggling, where we could see movement in seeding and how that affects things moving forward, and then get into some other substantive conversations on DeMar DeRozan's strong second half, on OKC's present and future, and what teams we're watching the next couple of weeks. Really good conversation brought to you by Prize Picks. Download the app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100 and Factor Meals. Go to factormeals.com/realgm50, R-E-A-L-G-M-5-0, and you get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month, which is awesome. Talk, of course, a lot more about those later on. But here's Jared Dubin. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's a good time, and I'm glad we got the audio issues hopefully sorted out.
Hopefully. Where I want to start, we're in kind of an interesting place relative to the season where we're about a month out of the play-in, and so we know a fair amount, but we don't know everything. And I think a good depiction of that is that after a couple losses this week, including to the Pels on Friday, the Clippers are actually closer to the five seed now. They're the four, but they're closer to the five than they are to the three. And there is no guarantee that they'll be there forever, but it is really a change from what I thought was going to be a hard road for Minnesota. And now the Clippers have a long way to claw back to get to the three, if we assume that's better for them.
Yeah, and they have getting to that three is important because that gets them out of the Nuggets bracket, who right now are the number one seed. They're tied with the Thunder in the loss column, but they have one more win because they played one more game. It's going to be interesting to see that dance from the Clippers based on what happens with Denver, Oklahoma City, and Minnesota at the top. Like, goal number one for them is likely to avoid the Nuggets until the conference finals, if possible.
The Nuggets are a really tough matchup for the Clippers. The Nuggets are playing extremely well, and we can also presume that at this point, no, nothing definitive, but if that series happens, odds are Denver would be the home team. You know, they would have home court advantage in that series. And so that's a lot to take on for the Clippers potentially. And it's also pretty notable this Clippers stumble, and it ties in with some of the concerns that I had about them in the stretch run. Were like their best games are still successful, but they had that game against the Bucks where they chose to, however we wanted to define it, sit some of their best players to give them a little bit of rest. And then Kawhi Leonard, thankfully it was a short back issue. And then James Harden missed the game against the Pels yesterday.
Yeah, obviously the injury issues are always going to be a big concern for them, specifically with their top few guys. They're missing Russell Westbrook right now as well.
Right.
So it's been Bones Highland playing the point for these past couple games. The first game was very good and had like 20-something points and I think 11 assists. The game against the Pelicans on Friday night, he was, you know, a pretty big issue out there, I think, on both ends. And it really hurt the Clippers, that I thought. But the bigger issue was that they just didn't have really any answer for Zion trying to get to the rim. And I think that points to sort of an issue that they have, I think, defending size in general. Like, big playmakers have caused them an issue, I think, whether that's Zion or Jokic or, you know, anybody sort of in that size range. Even though the Clippers are a team that's like on the bigger side in general, I think they've had issues defending that type of player.
That does make it unfortunate for them that the bracket may, I mean, obviously things aren't probably going to stay exactly where they are, but theoretically, let's say they did. Pels in the first round, if you make it through, Nuggets in the second.
I mean, I think ideally for them, they'd play the Thunder, right? Like that would be probably the best matchup for them in the second round.
Presumably, yeah.
Rather than Denver or Minnesota.
Minnesota, I wonder how, especially considering like we don't know what Towns would look like at that point. I worry about Minnesota's offense. But you brought up the big playmaker part. They could kind of work some stuff in. The other tactical wrinkle that would be really fun about a Clippers-Wolves series, which I would love to see, is how Gobert impacts a team that doesn't need to do everything around the basket. You know, like the Clippers, it's not the extreme of like the prime Warriors or anything like that. But, you know, Kawhi Leonard gets to his spot, and that works a little bit differently than some of the other guys, though, you know, of course, you could mess up some of the Harden Zubats actions and everything else.
Yeah, that's actually what I was just going to bring up. Almost right after I said it, I remembered. I wrote a few years ago at 538, and it was the Clippers Jazz Conference Finals. And it was like, you know, Rudy Gobert is the best rim protector in the league, but the Clippers like almost don't even try to get all the way to the rim. And they just exploit the kind of drop coverage by having these, you know, unbelievably good mid-range shooters and guys that are really good specifically at like sneaking the pick and roll and putting the defender in jail. Like Paul George is so good at that. And then obviously Kawhi basically doesn't miss from, you know, like 10 to 20 feet. And that would, I think, cause significant issues for the Wolves. So I know I brought it up at first. I'm much less sure about that series being an issue for them.
So I think it's worth taking a beat to appreciate what Denver has done. So Denver has only lost one game after the All-Star break. That was to the Phoenix Suns in a game that went to overtime. They did, you know, they did get beat up a little bit in that overtime, but whatever. It's a one game. And I believe, no, that wasn't a back-to-back. They had a gap. That was right. But it was two high-profile games. That's why I was thinking about it. So it is true that Denver, and you know, you never want to say like, oh, a team's won 11 out of their last 12. I believe that's what it is for Denver, that they're going to do that the rest of the way forward. But what it looks like to me when I've been watching them, and I mean, this came up in the Boston game, of course, high profile. And then I thought they did a pretty good job against Miami, even though got a little bit tight late, of just not only are they winning, but they're winning in the ways that make sense. Like it doesn't feel like an outlier other than just the sheer winning percentage volume.
Right. And they, you know, they're kicking teams' asses too. You know, like it's not like these are all close wins. Like they won by 20, 15, 16, 21, 10, 21, 12, 11. Like that's, what is that? Eight of the 11 wins in this stretch have been by double digits. And the one loss, like you said, was in overtime. And it's like, you know, Murray has shot unbelievably well since the break. Porter has shot unbelievably well since the break. He had that game where he went like 11 for 12 or 11 for 11 or whatever it was. Jokic obviously is like averaging a 28-point triple-double or whatever since the break. Like they're dominating in exactly the way you would think they would dominate. And they are just ripping off double-digit wins.
Something else that bodes well for them kind of looking at their schedule moving forward is that the Nuggets have a fair portion of their games against teams that are towards the bottom of the bracket. And so those are the games where, yes, they actually had a weird one against Toronto where Toronto had the lead for more of that game than we expected. But then Denver ended up pulling out the win by, I think it was 6. And so you have those that are probably should be close to a skate. I'm not saying it's 100% chance, but maybe it's like a 90-95. And then just this is the kind of scheduling thing that I hate, and I've ranted about this on Real GM Radio, on Dunked On a lot. Just so happens that the Nuggets play the Timberwolves 3 times the rest of the season, and they play them twice in about a week, and then they play them another time towards the end. And it's like, well, this is, knowing what we know right now, this is an advantageous time to play them. And you think about how those 3 games, you know, like that you get to play the Wolves without Towns. We'll see where the cumulative fatigue is for Minnesota. They did have that nice comeback win over the Clippers, but that bunching games can lead to these kinds of outcomes.
Yeah, and getting, you know, the Wolves specifically in that type of schedule, since they've given them some issues defensively just with their size and length, Minnesota has, I think that in particular works out really well for them, because that's obviously, you know, lessened with whether it's, you know, Kyle Anderson or Naz Reid out there in place of Towns, who, you know, isn't the guy that necessarily specifically gives them trouble defensively, but is, you know, much bigger than like when Kyle Anderson starts out there for them.
We'll probably go back to the West at some point, but I think what I was most interested in talking with you, because you're East Coast based, even though you watch everyone, is kind of how the East is shaking out. The one thing we do know is Boston. Like Boston, they haven't clinched the East yet, but they're getting reasonably close. Right now, Bucks and Cavs are tied in the loss column. I like to look at the loss column for good teams. And Mobley's still out. Unfortunately, I don't think we have a definitive timeline yet on him. I guess my question on that front is, are you feeling like any of the teams, there's the morass kind of from 4 to 8 headed by the Knicks right now. Do you think that 2 and 3 are more solid, or do you think that somebody with a hot stretch can realistically climb up back in and make that a race for the 3?
I mean, I think it kind of depends on who gets healthy. Like if the Knicks get Julius Randle back in the next couple of weeks, then maybe they can make a run, you know, to pick up, you know, 3 games, 3.5 games over the final, 16, 17, 18 games of the year. If they don't get him back or don't get Mitchell Robinson back, I think that's significantly less likely. You know, can the Magic keep all of their guards healthy for more than 2 games in a row? You know, can the Heat get Tyler Hero back? And who else was Rozier is already back. And yeah. Can the Sixers get Joel Embiid back, which doesn't seem all that likely. Like right now, those teams are both a half game back of Indiana, but they're all tied in the loss column. Like, you know, the Knicks, Magic, Pacers, Heat, and Sixers are separated by a total of 3 games, and that's the 4 to 8 seed. And then the Knicks are 3 behind Cleveland. It's like, to me, it's going to sort of depend on who gets their guys healthy, because, you know, Milwaukee doesn't have Chris Middleton still either. And Cleveland, obviously, like you said, doesn't have Evan Mobley. Donovan Mitchell has missed a bunch of games recently. Like, Max Strus has missed a bunch of games recently. Like, you know, it's crazy, the injuries that the teams like 2 to 8 in the East have been dealing with.
It feels to me like things are up for the taking, but one of the challenges you brought up getting healthy is also just the type of run that you would need to go on. I mean, that's, as you brought up there, you know, we're looking at 15, 16 games left in the season. Making up a 3-game margin there, first of all, you probably need the team that is ahead to lose some, which can absolutely happen, especially with the Cavs and Bucks being shorthanded relatively at certain points now. But it's also like, you're probably going to need to see a 12-4 or a, you know, like a 12-4 or a 13-3 to feel good about it, just because you wouldn't expect either the Bucks or the Cavs to go like well under 500. And so I think it's possible. And part of why I think it's so compelling is the numbers game of this. So it's not just, oh, it has to be the Knicks. The Knicks have to go, you know, 12-4 or something like that. It could be them. It could be the Magic. It could be the Pacers. But the reason why I think the way it happens is presumably be the Cavs coming back to the field rather than somebody coming to them, because of some of the injury issues that are not going to resolve quickly. Like, you brought up the Hero stuff. I mean, Joel Embiid looks like, according to Ramona Shelburne, he's not coming back before the very end of the regular season. And then Tyrese Halliburton's clearly dealing with a hamstring issue. Like, he doesn't have the same burst. He doesn't have quite the same stuff. So it's like, if you could snap your fingers today and tell me that Tyrese Halliburton is going to be the guy he was for the first half of the season and be that, like, he's fully healed tomorrow, then I would say, yeah, they could pull off that run even with some of their flaws. But it seems like he's going to be managing this, and it's unfortunate. I love Tyrese Halliburton. He's had an unbelievable year when he's been at his best. But it just happens that, like, I use the phrase sometimes, like, this team's fastball. Like, the Knicks and the Magic, to me, are the teams that have the best chance of actually having their fastball for even 2-3 weeks left of the remaining time, much less the whole thing.
Yeah, and, you know, OG Anunoby's been back for 2 games for the Knicks, and they've won by, what, like, almost 30, and then by double digits. They've got a pretty tough end of this road trip that they're on. They're at Sacramento, at Golden State, and at Denver over the next 3 games. If they keep, like, just absolutely demolishing everybody with Anunoby on the court, then they do seem like the most likely team to sort of make up that gap, even though the remaining teams are all packed pretty close. But it does seem less likely that, like, they'll beat all 3 of those specific teams on the road by that much. But it also seemed unlikely that they'd be, what are they, 14-2 now with OG on the court or something like that? Like, and most of these games just haven't been close at all. You know, like, it's, you know, something about that configuration has locked things in for them. You know, I don't think they are a 14-2. Like, what is that over the course of the season? That's, you know, 30 or 28-4, 56-8. Like, I don't think they're a 65, 68 win team. but they're clearly better than they are without him. So I guess it's theoretically possible in that they could go, you know, they've got, what, 16 games left. Like, can they go 13-3, 12-4, something like that? I guess it's just going to be tough specifically to do that because of how difficult their next three games are, and they're all on the road. And they also play Milwaukee and Boston on the road later in the year.
They do. And so the Knicks, if they can navigate this remaining stretch, they play Sacramento later today, and they play the Warriors on Monday, and then Denver on Thursday. If they can make it through that stretch relatively clean, like maybe one and two might be okay, because then they have a pretty soft stretch at mostly at home, and then they have a tough game against OKC. That'll be it's not a matinee. That would have been an even bigger advantage for them. But what might end up benefiting, we'll see, the Knicks is that, like, for example, they play Boston. You mentioned that. They play Boston at Boston, but they will have clinched everything by that point. And maybe the Celtics would – that's the type of game, if I were Joe Mazzulla, I would actually play my guys in and see it as, like, a playoff tune-up, because they're going to be clinched so early because you factor in the play-in. Like, there's a longer gap now, and we don't know who they would theoretically face as the eight, but you don't want to be, like, completely rusty by that point. But they play, you know, again, I brought up these bunching things. The Knicks play three games against the Bulls in the last 2 weeks of the season. What kind of Bulls team are they going to be facing? What's that situation going to be? But yeah, if the threshold is 12-4, I think that's a lot to ask for the Knicks. But if the Cavs, probably them, come back to the field and it can be, you know, 11-5 or something like that, maybe that gets interesting.
Yeah, Boston, to your point about wanting to use that game as a playoff tune-up, the Boston does play Milwaukee the game before the Knicks, and both teams are on the front end of a back-to-back for that Knicks-Celtics game. So, you know, there could be some, you know, resting going on for one of the two teams there. The Knicks don't rest guys, so it won't be them. But Boston could decide that we're not going to play against the Knicks, and we'll play everybody against, you know, Charlotte the next night.
Could be. That'll be worth watching. Plenty more to discuss, but first a message from Prize Picks. Prize Picks is the largest daily fantasy sports platform in North America, the easiest and most exciting way to play DFS. It's just you against the numbers. Instead of battling thousands of other players, including pros and sharks, you pick more than or less than on 2-6 player stat projections and watch the winnings roll in. If you want to play alongside some of Prize Picks' favorite players like Meek Mill and Sugar Sean O'Malley, you can find community plays under the promo tabs of the app to view entries from some of the biggest names in the Prize Picks community every week. And I love that Prize Picks even offers injury insurance so that your entries stay in play even if one of your players gets injured. For basketball games, if you have a player who leaves the game in the first half and doesn't return for the second, that player projection won't count against you, and the rest of your entry stays live. I think that's really cool. And that ties in with my favorite thing about Prize Picks, that it is player-specific. So if there is a matchup you like, or in some ways, even you call it juicier, a matchup you don't like for a specific player, then you just pick more than or less than, and you can work with that, whether it's a high-profile player or a lower-profile player. If you see something you like, you can check it out. And this is a great time to try out Prize Picks, because if you download their app today and use the code CLNS, you get a first deposit match up to $100. Again, download the Prize Picks app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy at Prize Picks. I'll open the floor to you. I mean, there are a lot of different other areas. I know you did a piece on DeMar DeRozan recently, but wherever you want to start, we'll have a couple places we'll go, but wherever you want to start is where we'll go next.
Yeah, I highlighted DeRozan specifically. Like, I love his step three move. Everybody obviously talks about the mid-range stuff with him and the pump fakes. Like, he's the best pump faker in the league. It's unbelievable how often guys bite on his pump fake. I tried to get data on that from the NBA because they have access to the new tracking data, but they said they don't have anything on pump fakes yet. They're going to try to get some of that for, you know, whether it's next season or the summer or something along those lines. So I was disappointed not to be able to get that, but, you know, they didn't know to track it yet. So we'll see what happens there. But yeah, he had like 4 or 5 step through baskets where it's like he gets to his spot on the floor and then up fakes. And instead of drawing the foul, like he usually does, just sort of steps through, did that a bunch of times against the Pacers. And he's having a really, really good season then. It's like, you know, I don't think it's, you know, borderline All-NBA or anything like that, but, you know, just sort of toiling in obscurity for the Bulls, doing what he does every single year. So I wanted to highlight him there. And then the other stuff I put in that story was, you know, Josh Hart's playmaking getting much more adventurous since the Knicks lost Julius Randle and OG. Like, he's gone from averaging, you know, 4.8 assists per 100 possessions to 7.6.
Wow.
9.3 potential assists to 12.9. And he is both being more closely guarded as a passer and throwing to passes to more closely guarded teammates when you look at the tracking data. So it's just like a sort of all-encompassing passing adventurousness improvement, I guess. And the last thing I looked at there was Keon Ellis from the Kings, who, like, I'm sort of falling in love with his game. He is 14th in the league in deflections per 36 minutes out of the 324 players who have played at least 500 minutes this year. And then if he qualified for the leaderboards by playing enough minutes, he would be one of only five players with steal and block rates of 2.5% or better. And the others are Shai, Matisse Thybulle, Alex Caruso, and Andre Drummond. So, like, he's just a really, really good defensive playmaker. And I'm interested to see him play more with that starting group for Sacramento, because I think it gives them something that they don't really have from the rest of the guys in that group.
Keon Ellis's development, emergence, however we want to classify it, is such a fascinating story, in part because Davion Mitchell's reputation, and Davion Mitchell, like, I still like him as a defensive player, but his reputation when, you know, off night and everything else was like, oh, he's going to be the defensive disruptor, and if the offensive game comes around, great. And obviously the Kings expected more of that offensive game when they drafted him in the lottery, but that was the theory. And then Keon Ellis comes in and we're like, oh, at first I'm like, oh, maybe he can be a more, you know, like, potentially a stabilizing force offensively. He's like, nah, not really. Like, that's not the best part of his game, but he's more of a defensive playmaker rather than a, like, positional defender. Mm-hmm. But defensive playmakers are great on the perimeter, and they can be useful as starters, and they can be useful off the bench. Like, Thybulle's a really good example of that. Like, he's not a perfect player, but he can really discombobulate what the other team wants to do.
Yeah, and I think part of what makes it, you know, more useful specifically in the context of the Kings is Davion Mitchell's, what, like, 6'1" or something like that? The Kings are already playing, obviously, De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk a ton of minutes, and those guys are like 6'2", 6'3", whatever they are. Keon Ellis is like 6'6", and that just, like, you can play the three of those guys together. You can't really play Fox, Monk, and Mitchell together. Like, you're just way too small, especially for a team that isn't great at protecting the interior. Like, you need to have some bigger guys out there with them.
Agreed. And that ties in with something that Nate looked into about the Kings' rim protection being better this year. And he's like, is it Sabonis? No, it's that they're deploying some of the other guys. Keegan Murray's doing this, a few of their others, at, you know, being around the basket a little bit more. And because you're going to have, there are different ways to do that. One of them is to try to reduce the amount of times the team is at the basket in the first place. That's a part of what Keon Ellis can do. But yeah, it is a challenge that Sacramento, I think Mike Brown has done a relatively good job navigating it, considering their limitations. Like, there's only so much that you can do. And Keon Ellis can be a key part of that solution.
Yeah, and then just, like, when you're not a very good defensive team, having someone who can take possessions away from the other team is so valuable. Like, it'll just, you know, get you possessions where there's no shot. Like, possessions where there are no shot are so valuable for teams that don't play very good, you know, shooting defense for one reason or another. And obviously, I would imagine, I haven't looked at the rebound rates, but, like, he's so much bigger. I would imagine he's a significantly better rebounder than someone like Mitchell as well. And I would imagine he's a better rebounder than, like, Kevin Herter, who doesn't, you know, grab all that many boards to begin with. So, I mean, I really like him, and I want to see him get more minutes for them, and I'm intrigued to see what happens with him and with them down the stretch of the season.
I want to go back to DeMar DeRozan. There was a point earlier in the year, and this is why it's always good to check in on players, reevaluate and everything, where he was really struggling. I mean, so through the first 2 months of the season, he was well below league average in true shooting, and then has heated up, and he's been incredible in February and March specifically. And first of all, DeMar DeRozan has played the most minutes in the NBA this year, which is really impressive for somebody this is his age 34 season, playing 37.7 per game, but also the 24-52 that he's played so far is the most in the league. By the way, number two, his teammate Coby White. So I guess the Bulls are holding on to a tradition of their former coach. And I was really impressed with DeRozan's 46-point game against the Pacers. He really was what kept Chicago in and was so key in overtime, especially after Coby White got hurt. Thankfully, Coby White's injury is not severe. They're describing it as a hip strain. May miss a little bit of time, but not too much. And for DeRozan, there was a point early in the year, and this happens when you're an older player, you know, mentioned age 34 season, and things are, you know, below the usual standard. So he still doesn't take that many threes. He's, you know, his 2-point attempt rate had dropped, and he was making fewer of them. And you're like, okay, maybe this is when that happens. And to his immense credit, what DeRozan has basically shown over the course of the full sample, and this is why you wait for it, is, you know, maybe there's a little bit of a step back, but it is a much, much, much more modest step back than I had feared at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, like, he's using fewer possessions, not, you know, forcing as many things as if he has to be the top playmaker. Like, I think it's interesting that, you know, Zach LaVine has been out for basically the whole year, and this is DeRozan's lowest usage rate since 2013, you know, and like, I think that's allowed him to keep up the efficiency. Like, that combined with the fact that he just parades himself to the free throw line a million times a night, like, his free throw rate is pretty unbelievable. But, you know, those two things combined, I think, have allowed him to sort of maintain what he's been able to do over the last few years. Like, I know he made whatever it was, like five, six All-Star teams in, you know, the last few years that he was with Toronto. But I really think he's played, like, the best basketball of his career in the last two or three years. It's pretty unbelievable. And doing it on, you know, these sort of nothing Bulls teams. Like, I can't believe they didn't trade him at the deadline. And Caruso. Like, what are we doing here?
There definitely is the what are we doing here element. And with DeRozan, you want to appreciate what he's doing right now and the season that he's having. And the Bulls, like, I mean, they have a part to play in all this. It's a weird part, but, like, I mean, I've posited the idea that if Embiid's not back until the end of the regular season, there's an outside chance it would have to be Philly falling back to them that the Bulls could actually pass the Sixers, which would be a hugely important thing for play-in seeding, because if the Sixers fall to the 9, the best they can do is the 8 seed, and thus would play the Celtics if they make it. But with the Bulls, like with DeRozan, it's this idea of Ben Golliver and I talked about it. He used the phrase basketball mortality. And so it definitely appears that DeMar DeRozan, you know, like, he can be a productive player in the league for some remaining time. How many years that is, we don't know. But him being an unrestricted free agent in a year where not that many good teams have cap space, but some good teams may potentially have the flexibility to structure a sign-and-trade if the Bulls are amenable, all that type of stuff. And what I'm fascinated by with him is not, like, what is his role going to be wherever he is, whether it's Chicago or elsewhere. It's what does he want out of his age 35, age 36 season, because he's made plenty of money, and I, you know, players can prioritize whatever they want. I'm not going to criticize them for that. I only criticize hypocrisy. Like, if you go to a bad team and then complain that you're on a bad team. But with him, I could see a multitude of things. I could see him taking a pay cut to be on a really good team because that hasn't, you know, he hasn't really had that championship taste. I could see him wanting to prioritize money because, hey, it's money. Even though he's made a lot in his career, there's no reason that he has to take a sacrifice now. Or it could be something like, hey, he wants to play closer to where he grew up in LA. Does he want to play, just do something else? And I've lamented how uninspiring I expect the 2024 free agent class to be, just because odds are a lot of guys are going to re-up and like, you know, like there are high-powered guys, even with Kawhi re-signing. But DeMar DeRozan could really shift some stuff depending on what he wants.
Yeah, I think no matter what he wants, he's probably very thankful to former NBPA president Chris Paul for changing the over 35 rule to the over 38 rule, which is going to allow him to get probably a longer deal than he could have signed if it was still over 35. So that must be nice for him. And, you know, still playing at a high level, like, you would think that, like, he might be one of the only free agents that's available this offseason that teams are like, he could be an actual difference maker that is actually going to potentially leave his team. Like, it's widely expected that, like, Paul George and James Harden are going to re-sign with the Clippers, and OG Anunoby is going to re-sign with the Knicks, and Pascal Siakam is going to re-sign with the Pacers, and Drew Holiday is going to re-sign with the Celtics. Like, those things are pretty widely expected, and I'm trying to think, you know, who else is or might be hitting free agency this offseason. I guess Klay Thompson, right? Could be a free agent this summer. Am I wrong?
He will be a free agent this summer, absent an extension. And he could potentially be changing. I mean, again, another player that nobody has any idea what he wants. But yeah, if we're talking about the highest profile players that we feel have a realistic chance of changing teams, I would say Nick Claxton, Miles Bridges, DeMar DeRozan, and that's probably it. I mean,
LeBron has an opt out, right?
LeBron has an opt out, but I think that it's not expected that he's going to leave. You know, he could
We'll have to see what happens with Bronny if he comes into the draft or not.
True.
It doesn't seem like it's going to happen, but if he does, then it puts a lot of things in play for LeBron. Obviously,
it does, and I mean, there are ways. I mean, obviously, the hope was that Bronny was going to be healthy and that he was going to be a really good prospect, and that he could that it could potentially force a more challenging decision. I mean, obviously, it's. I think that at times everyone, and I don't blame media or anybody for this, has deprived Bronny of his own agency in this. But one of the benefits, if it's something that he wants and something his family, you know, whoever he listens to, is one of the benefits of having a challenging first year on campus is that if what he wants is to have a little bit more fluidity in his destination, like basically to fall far enough that like the Lakers could pick him or something like that, well, that has occurred. And so this happens sometimes. Bronny is obviously a very different name value and everything like that. Like there are some international prospects who believe in their potential, who actually declare after a down year in terms of the rep, because it might open up more possibilities. And it, in some ways, it's if there are scenarios of what Bronny might want where being a little bit of a later pick could be useful.
Yeah, I mean, just specifically because it makes it more likely that his dad's team, whatever it is, can get him.
Sure.
Like,
well, and just, I mean, even though LeBron is a cyborg sent from the future to run basketball, he might not play until he's 45. So like if that's something that Bronny wants, then you have a narrow window. And so if you can make it happen in the early side of that window, that's better than the later side.
Yeah, for sure.
Plenty more to discuss, but first a message from Factor Meals. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-certified, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular choices like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. If you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. They're no muss, no fuss. Prepping, cooking, and cleanup, they're tailored to your schedule. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. And Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. And the way you check this out is you go to factormeals.com/realgm50, R-E-A-L-G-M-50. And that number is there for a reason. You get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. And I'm a huge fan of their product. Definitely think you should check it out. So again, the URL, factormeals.com/realgm50. You get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. So as we're kind of like working our way through the league, one of the questions that I've been kind of trying to navigate is the capability of the team. So currently like the 7-10 in the West. So it's the Suns, the Mavs, the Lakers, and the Warriors. It's not only that you have a ton of star power, because obviously you do, but you also have teams that, conceptually at least, at their best, can be genuinely dangerous. And that is no guarantee that they will, A, make it out of the play-in, or B, like, that they're going to pass the Kings, or much less the Pelicans, or anything like that. But what I've been trying to reconcile over the last couple weeks in particular, and I've complained about a couple of the Lakers games recently, where I'm just wondering if, at least for some of those teams, the Suns, due to their injury context, might be a little bit of a different thing, whether we're holding on to a version of those teams that isn't really there now.
Yeah, I would say, like, I am leaning well towards the side that, yes, we are. Specifically, I think, with the Lakers and the Warriors, because obviously LeBron and Steph have sort of defined the last 10 years of, you know, like championship contention. And, you know, those teams are in the play-in mix. Obviously, we saw the Warriors win the title 2 years ago and the Lakers make a run from the play-in to the conference finals last year. But if they stay in 9 and 10, first of all, one of them by definition cannot make the playoffs. And the other one, the best they can do is playing potentially the Nuggets in the first round. And I don't think the Lakers have anything for the Nuggets. And we saw last year, the Warriors really don't either, right? Like, you know, that they neither one of them can really deal with Jokic, and neither one of them is all that well equipped to deal with Murray either. For those two teams specifically, I think it's very difficult. If you can get into the 7-8, you could potentially get Oklahoma City or Minnesota. And I think that this sort of brings up something that I think is somewhat connected. Like, Oklahoma City is going to win, like, you know, 55-ish games, if not more. And the Thunder are, I'm going to check on it right now, are they the youngest team by minutes weighted age, or like second or third? Typically, those things are like, they are the second youngest team by 0.2 years. They're 3.3 years younger than the league average team. Typically, teams that young win like 25 games, and they're going to win like 55 to 60, somewhere around there, depending on how well they end the rest of the season. I'm curious, when it comes to their playoff outlook, young teams generally don't do all that well, mostly because young teams generally don't make the playoffs. And if they do, they're on the lower end of the bracket. Teams as good as Oklahoma City is going to be at the end of the season, and as good as their point differential is, like, they're second in the league in net rating, teams that good generally do extremely well in the playoffs. So how do you reconcile the profile of how good they're going to be with how young they still are? Because, you know, typically people say, like, oh, you know, they're too young, they don't have the experience. But usually the young teams that don't have the experience are not this good. Like, it's, to me, it's such an interesting dichotomy.
There is the old crawl, walk, run idea of playoff success, and that you generally, you know, whether it's getting used to playoff officiating or something else, but you are right that part of the reason it's crawl, walk, run is that teams just don't start out well enough to run. And I'm not sure with the Thunder, and there are elements of it. I mean, they're going to be hard to defend, pretty much everyone who's there. I mean, they play five out. They have so many guys who can dribble, shoot, and pass on the team. It's going to be hard that way. And then they have a strong defensive foundation. This is the number six defense in the league per Cleaning the Glass right now. And another element of this is that not only are they a young team, but they have a coach who is simultaneously both new to the playoffs, but also very good in Mark Daigneault. Like, I think Mark Daigneault is on the short list of the best coaches in the NBA right now. And that said, you and I remember we've had a lot of discussions about playoff coaching, and we know that it is a somewhat different animal, and it's making adjustments, it's counters and anticipations and matchups and rotation decisions. And while I am more confident that Mark Daigneault will do a good job in those decisions than basically any coach who is going into their first playoffs, I can't be sure. Like, it's just one of those things that you can't, you know, that the Thunder are typically extremely well prepared. They know what their opponents are trying to do. And I think that Daigneault, broadly speaking, knows which of his players are good and great and which ones are less good and great. But it's another big variable for them that we will know, but we just don't know now.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to find, like, a comparable team. Like, they are the 2-7. They are the eighth youngest team since the ABA-NBA merger in 1976. And, like, there are only 31 teams that have had a minutes weighted age of 24 or younger than 24 years old. The only other one that's won more than 55, that's won 55 games or more, is the 2011 Thunder. And they went to the Western Conference Finals. Like, it's not unheard of, I guess, theoretically, for a team that young to make a deep run in the playoffs, because the only other team that's been that good that young is, like, the early KD, Russ, Harden, Ibaka guys. And it's like, they've got a somewhat similar setup now. Like, it's pretty crazy.
It's a lot to take in. And I mean, the fact that it happens to be the same franchise with the same decision maker is incredible. Like, that you would have these two anomalies that happen in the same place and that are connected in many different ways. And with OKC, I think that it's going to be a really challenging dance for them, because you have the expectations of a team that is this good, this young, but also the practicality of, like, they haven't been there before and there are pitfalls and we don't know who they're going to play and all that type of stuff. But I don't want to get into this necessarily. I've talked about this probably 500 times on Real GM Radio over the last few years, is OKC, because of their salary structure, because of the picks they have more options on the table than most teams really in modern history ever have. And what I mean by that is they have a really strong foundation. And I would assume that Shea, Chet Holmgren, and Jalen Williams will be a part of this group wherever you go. But what makes the Thunder different is that you can put a lot of things around that and it would work. But what do they most prioritize, and what are they willing to sacrifice resources for, especially if you acknowledge that, okay, let's say those three guys are special, which I firmly believe that they are. Well, you are going to have to eventually pay them. And I don't think that the Thunder are going to be like a second apron team. Maybe they could be a first apron team at some point, but they're not going to be a second apron team unless and until they've already won a championship. So they can get into we use their assets, even if they're non-premium outside of those guys, because if you're not going to include Jalen or Chad or anything. So what is Sam Presti? I mean, I think he's going to hold firm, but I've thrown out some wild ideas. Like, they could theoretically trade for Lauri Markkanen and then renegotiate him. So the renegotiation extension is tricky, but the renegotiation actually is not. Or they could call the Pelicans about Zion. Like, you could go... They would do it more in a volume asset standpoint, but I don't think they're going to do anything like that. But the idea that Sam Presti could basically make a credible offer for almost any player in the NBA and not sacrifice their best guys is ludicrous.
You could also still have a ton of draft capital left over after doing that. And the big thing you need when you make these star acquisition type of moves is you still need to be able, if you have 3, 4, 5 high salary guys at or close to the max, you need cost controlled young players that are going to get better over the course of their contracts to surround them. And that often becomes an issue when you make one of those kind of trades, because you give up so many picks. OKC can still have 7, 8 of those picks left over after making one of those type of deals, which is pretty nuts. And that will allow them to, whether they pursue, another high salary, high, super high impact star type of player or not, having that pick volume, even if a lot of the picks land in the mid to late first rounds, it just gives them so many bites at the apple and so many opportunities to add role players around those guys, and role players who should get better during the course of their time with the team, and guys that they don't need to thrust into big roles right away, and they can sort of develop them. And if they want to, at the end of their contract, we're not going to retain Kenrich Williams or Aaron Wiggins or Lou Dort or whoever, they have the bandwidth to be able to replace those guys and it not kill them. It's pretty unbelievable, the situation that they're in right now.
You mentioned this, but I think it bears a little bit of emphasis that part of what makes the decision Sam Presti has left different than everyone else is that they're not looking for a high usage offensive engine. I think that Shea is one of the best players in the league. He's currently in the MVP conversation. And then you have Jalen Williams, who I really believe in. And if you're a Josh Giddey fan or some of the other things, they have players there. So I'm not saying, nobody who can handle the ball or anything like that, but it's not something you need to prioritize. And so then also over the years, some of the role player niches, those guys don't always get paid. That's part of why Mikal Bridges has, in my opinion, one of the best contracts in the league. We'll see how Jaden McDaniels' contract ages and all that. Is that you're throwing these assets, even if they're not premium, at positional types and niches that aren't typically super valued within the league. So maybe you can get a better player in that. And one guy that I've been a little bit fixated on, I don't think I've talked about this publicly, as a potential OKC target, which is awkward because I think his current team really likes him, is Jalen Suggs. And the theory behind me with Suggs on the Thunder is I love Shea as a defender, but I don't love him as an on-ball guy. And I don't know for sure that Jalen Suggs' three-pointer is going to be what it is, what is going to continue to be what it has been this year. But young player, continuing to get better, and who can defend on ball and not kill your spacing and fit within the feel of the team. So you could say, OKC, Orlando doesn't want to trade Jalen Suggs. They like Jalen Suggs. When he's been healthy, he's actually been really good for them. But if OKC offers three first-round picks. Can Orlando really afford to say no?
I don't know. Like, I don't know necessarily know that Suggs would cost even three first-round
picks. I don't think he would, but it's like they can make an offer even with, like, non-premium assets where it would the Magic would just be like, well, crap, we really like him, but we just drafted Anthony Black. We have all these other things. Like, what are we going to do here?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult for me to see that just because the Magic's identity is built so much around their defense, and Suggs is like this unbelievable defender. I think if they were gonna trade him, it would probably be for more of like a creator type.
Mm-hmm.
But you also don't have to sell me on Jalen Suggs on the Thunder. Like, I love Suggs so much. Like, he's going to be obviously very firmly in the mix for all defense this year. Man, I would love to see him play next to Shea in the backcourt. That would be so much fun.
It would be one of the best watches in the league, which the Thunder already are. So yeah, with OKC.
And then like seeing him with Lou Dort and Jalen Williams guarding guys on the perimeter and Chet at the basket. I mean, my God, like.
Yeah, it would be incredible. And again, Jalen Suggs, I love him. He's not an all NBA type of player. Like they could even throw a couple bites of the apple. They even have a couple of bites of the apple. Lou Dort is having this great shooting season. We'll see what Cason Wallace ends up being. And then there's the huge question mark that is Josh Giddey about like, what does he fit into? He's had this really challenging year. And with Giddey, the development of Jalen Williams as a creator has definitely taken the, like, some of the pressure off of Giddey. Like, it's not screwing up the franchise as much as it could. But there is still a chance, and it's weird that I'm thinking about it in this context, but I think it's kind of fair. The parallels between that and the Garland-Sexton dynamic, where Darius Garland became the player the Cavs wanted Colin Sexton to be. Colin Sexton has some injuries, eventually gets traded, but is a much better player now than he was then. It wouldn't surprise me in the slightest for that to happen with Josh Giddey.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me either. And I do think it's like, if you had to ask me, like, who is one player on the Thunder that's going to get traded in the next 18 months? Like, 1,000% my answer would be Giddey, just because he is probably the fourth most, like, he probably has the fourth most trade value on the team. They're not trading the other three guys, and they're probably not going to want to pay Giddey's next contract because they are going to want to pay Chet and Jalen's next contracts, and they're both going to be maxes, right? Like, so it just makes sense to me that whatever they do, it's going to be like Giddey and whatever else for whatever they decide is the thing that they need.
It makes intuitive sense to me. There, I'm sure there's also pressure that Sam Presti's putting on himself where it's like I think they still believe in him, where it's like, well, why would we trade Josh Giddey if the player we get for him doesn't have the potential that he does? But part of what makes Giddey, and there are parallels with various different players, I think of Ben Simmons in some ways with this, is that the really good passer who isn't that good at the other phases of offense is actually a much harder fit. Like, this used to come up a lot with the 6'2" guys who were really good passers and couldn't do anything else. But the marginal benefit of doing that when you're 6'8", 6'9", does exist, especially because you can defend different positions. But if you don't have the athleticism to, like, beat your guy, and Ben Simmons, of course, has a million other challenges, including physical ones, it doesn't usually work as well as you'd hope.
Yeah, also when everybody leaves you open on the perimeter and when you're not necessarily like a, you know, a super positive defender,
right?
That obviously makes it more difficult too. And I think Giddey sort of gets victimized in two different ways on defense, whether it's with physicality or with speed and athleticism. So, you know, I think it's just difficult to make it work, but that doesn't mean he can't succeed on another team that's more built around his type of skill set. But then do you want to be a team building around his skill set? What's the ceiling of that when, you know, his best skills are like his best served on the ball, but also he's not enough of a scoring threat on the ball, I think, to make him your lead ball handler. And that just all gets sort of complicated.
It does. And I think that being in a different circumstance in time could be good for him. And I brought up Sexton before. One of the things that I think has really benefited Sexton beyond being coached by Will Hardy, who I think does a good job, was the Jazz kind of having a wide open hierarchy. And so the idea basically being like, okay, we have Lauri Markkanen, we have this front court, and incidentally, a lot of those guys have been hurt a lot of this year, but the backcourt was always wide open. And so what that meant was, we're going to kind of see what works. And Sexton having this really nice year, it just so happens that Clarkson had a down year, and Keontae George, I think, has been an underappreciated story. Just Nate and Feldman did some work on this, but like, basically, there are almost no non-lottery point guards that have ever played this many minutes in their rookie year. It's extremely rare. Like, Drew Holiday did it and a few others. And so like there's some good stuff there. And maybe that's what Giddey needs. It's not to be put on a team where they have this exact role and the pressure that comes with it, but maybe it's a young team that's trying to figure stuff out. Like San Antonio could actually be an interesting question here. And if it works with Giddey, great. And if it doesn't work with him, then they would be able to do another move at some point rather than him being the focal point.
I love that for them and for him. Like, if there's anybody that can cover up for whatever, you know, Giddey's shortcomings are, it's Victor Wembanyama. And there are a bunch of good targets for OKC to pursue on San Antonio, obviously. Like Devin Vassell, like, yes, please, for them. Even Keldon Johnson would be interesting for them. And yeah, I mean, I kind of love that. And Keontae George, by the way, has just been unbelievably good lately. Like the first run he had as a starter early in the year didn't really go all that well. But since he re-entered the starting lineup, whenever it was, 20-something games ago, maybe it's more than that at this point, but he's been awesome. His jumper has really come on. And like I think he looks more athletic than he did when he was in college. Like, or, man, it really has not been 20 games that he re-entered the starting lineup. It's 12, but he had been playing well, I think, off the bench before that. Like, in the last 18 games, he's averaging 17, 3, and 5 on 46, 42, 86 shooting in 30 minutes a night. Like, that's really, really good stuff down the stretch of the season. Granted, it is, you know, February, March basketball on a going nowhere type of team, and he's just being afforded an absolute ton of opportunity, but that can also be really good for a young player in his position, particularly one that needed to like mold into shape based on what we saw from him earlier in the year.
Before we move into kind of the last topic, I wanted to ask you about one curiosity I had, because you covered this team, so that's why I have the question. Okay, Luke Kornet, you were around that 18-19 Knicks team. He was taking like, I think it was like 8 three-pointers per 36 minutes and making a lot of them. Luke Kornet has not taken a single three-pointer this entire season. Do you have any explanation for this?
Especially on a team that shoots as many threes as the Celtics, I really don't. But also, Luke Kornet, when called upon to play, has been awesome. Like, he's just been really good. He's protected the rim well. He's rebounded really well. He's been efficient on like the finishes inside. Obviously, it helps to have, you know, as many different guys to create his looks for him as he's had in Boston. Like, he's shooting 70% from the field this year. Like, I just think he's been a really valuable third center for them. Like, he's played, I'm looking at it now, he's played in 48 games. He's played 723 minutes, which is like 80 away from his career high set last year. He's made a few starts when they've had both KP and Horford out. He's rebounded well, offensive rebounded really well, specifically, like blocking shots. Whatever they're doing there with him, it's working.
It is. And I mean, Boston has an embarrassment of riches in a variety of ways. I think that Luke Kornet is certainly among them. The last thing I wanted to ask you about is what teams, you know, we usually do this as like the next 2 weeks. So like, what teams are you going to be focusing on? What situations, players, that kind of stuff? So not the absolute stretch run, but kind of like the early stretch run.
Yeah, I think it's the middle of both conferences that most interests me, because I want to see who's going to be able to avoid the play-in, who is going to get healthy, and who of those teams looks like the biggest threat to the top of the conference, and if any of them can be a threat to the top of the conference. Like, one of the biggest things to me is like, who's going to wind up as the 4-5 in the East, because that team's going to have to play Boston in the second round. And like, is whoever lands in that spot going to be an actual threat, or are the Celtics going to sort of walk to the conference finals, even though they always make things more difficult on themselves than they should be? And like, can the Clippers avoid a second round matchup with the Nuggets? Can OKC get the top seed and home court advantage throughout the playoffs? Like, can the Pelicans and the Kings stave off the Suns and the Mavericks? Like, that those are the kind of things that I'm going to be looking for, because I think 7-10 in the East, for the most part, seems like it's set. Like, maybe the Pacers drop down and the Heat or Sixers move up, but it's hard for me to see the Sixers moving up if Embiid's not going to be back anytime soon. Obviously, Boston is very far ahead at the top of the West, and then it's like, it looks like Denver, OKC, Minnesota, in some order, is going to be the top three in the West. So, like, a lot of stats outside of the, you know, 4-8 range in both conferences, and to a lesser extent, the 2-8 range in the East is kind of set. So it's all about that sort of jumble in the middle.
Agreed on all that. And I want to get into some specific players that I'm going to be watching. So that Cavs Pelicans game that I focused on was fascinating for a lot of reasons. I mean, you had the Cavs shooting a billion threes and making a billion threes against a Pelicans team that gives up a ton. But Donovan Mitchell did not look good physically. He had gotten that PRP injection, had missed 7 or 8 games straight. And there's a month for him to get right. But as well as Cleveland has played this year, and they've played well, you know, in various different iterations with injuries, he needs to be right. Like, that is, for them to do anything in the playoffs, he's going to need to be there. Doesn't really matter who they play. Like, maybe they could skate out of a first round series against the Magic or something like that, but it's going to be tough. So him, and then one of the ones that's kind of, it's under the radar because they're not going to make the playoffs, but I mean, we have reporting that Desmond Bane and potentially Brandon Clark are going to come back this year. And I'm a big believer in Memphis, like, organizationally, like, kind of what they could be next year. And so we're not going to get Ja. We're not going to get the best versions of this. But, like, what does Bane look like? What does Clark look like? That will give us some information for next year. So I'm interested in both of those. And then for me, we talked about this earlier in the show, but I think we're going to get more information on that 7-10 in the West. And it's what of these teams can really put a charge into it? Like, what is there a team in that group that can, whether they make it to the 6 or not, that can really threaten one of these 4 best teams in the Western Conference? And I would love for that to be the case, not only because it makes the playoffs more interesting, but because it could be good for them organizationally long term. And honestly, to me, it could be any of them. The Suns are the most logical because they haven't really had their best players, and when they have, they've been very good. But I could see the Mavs causing problems too. The other challenge of it, and it's why this is getting trickier, is it's looking more like to me that the best teams in the West are going to be in the 1-2, which then shifts things. It increases the pressure. It's not going to be one of those like the Warriors-Sacramento where you're the lower seed, but you have a better pedigree and are arguably a better team.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on the Suns being the most likely of that group to either make a jump up or to threaten the top of the conference. The issue with them making a jump up is that they have the second toughest schedule in the league down the stretch of the season, and they can't keep, you know, KD, Booker, and Beal on the court at the same time for more than like 3 consecutive games. So, you know, that obviously makes things tougher for them. And now Dallas has Luka dealing with this hamstring thing. You know, even like LeBron is still sitting out some games. Obviously, Steph is, did they say he's going to be back yet? I saw there was an update the other day. I don't remember exactly.
I think he's in process, but it's not all the way yet. I haven't seen anything in the last day or two.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that we'll see him against the Lakers tonight. And I think LeBron and AD were both considered questionable for that game too, if I'm remembering correctly. And then Draymond is also questionable with one of his various things that he's got going on. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I think we can leave it there. I will thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, man. I always enjoy it.
Thanks again to Jared Dubin for taking the time to come on. You can and should read his excellent work at Last Night in Basketball, which is on Substack. And you can follow him on social media if you don't already. And if you're an NFL fan, his NFL work is great too, though, of course, we're knee-deep in that offseason. Love having him on. And if you want to support Real GM Radio, there are a lot of different things you can do. You can subscribe and download this podcast in whatever podcast player you choose, Spotify, Apple, wherever. We appreciate it. And that's great for Real GM Radio because it's never going to come out on a specific day of the week. It's my availability, guests, everything like that. So it can do that. And if we're not on a platform that you would like us to be, let me know and I will pass it along. That is not something I can fix, but I can pass it along to other people who can at least give me an answer to give back to you. You can also help other people find the show by leaving a rating and review in the podcast player of your choosing, or by word of mouth or social media. All of that is greatly appreciated. But the most important thing you can do for Real GM Radio and any other podcast that has them is to check out our sponsors. For this episode, that is Prize Picks. You download their app and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. And then the awesome offer from Factor Meals, which I really like, factormeals.com/realgm50. That's the URL that you type in. factormeals.com/realgm50. I'm going to read the whole thing out because I want to. And the reason why is because you get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month, which is a really awesome offer for them. I've been extremely impressed with their product. And if you want to support my other work, I do really appreciate that. Dunked On Prime, still going strong. Nate and I are doing position rankings. We're doing 15 and 60s. We're doing gamers. We're going to be, you know, getting closer to awards and the playoff hunt and everything else. And my, if you're a subscriber, then my stuff like my regular season schedule book and everything else and all the other great work that we're doing is there. I'm so thrilled of the whole endeavor and how well it's been going this season. You can also check out my written work at The Athletic. You can check out the NBA strategy stream, which will be back on Thursday and Sunday of the coming week. We're doing Pelicans Magic, I'm sure, on Thursday. I can't remember exactly what we're doing next Sunday. It's more than a game away, so sometimes I forget. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielLaRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is a promise. I'm not the greatest at replying. I'm a new father, all that type of stuff, but I will always read it. That is why I tell you that, and I do every single day. And that is all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.